Luke is, in my estimation, one of the most significant figures in the history of homeopathy, not only as an excellent practitioner and educator, but as somebody who has worked tirelessly to constantly contribute to our understanding of the principles as laid down by Hahnemann and the Organon, to bring back a clear understanding of the methods of posology as they relate to various editions of the Organon. He's done tremendous work in the area of the delusions as they relate to homeopathy, tremendous miasmatic work. He is the author of a number of books. I use Maintaining and Achieving the Similimum regularly in the classes that I teach, and I actually think it's probably one of the most important books ever written in homeopathy, so I highly recommend that work. All of his works are excellent, but that work in particular struck me as being a very, very significant work for advancing our understanding and practice of the science and art of homeopathy. So we're always very fortunate to have Dr. Luke join us. He's a wealth of information. He's got a wonderful heart. He gives tirelessly to his students and his patients, and it's always a great pleasure. So thank you again, Luke, for joining us.
Thank you. I actually need a vacation, but my vocation is working right now.
Yes, I know you do need a vacation, don't you? Okay. So the topic of the call this evening is about the Luke de Shepper module, which was just recently released by Archibel. And I actually had the opportunity to go to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where Dr. Luke was teaching, and I just gave a quick presentation of the module during the lunch break, and people were absolutely wowed. I mean, they just came up after the presentation and said, "This is fantastic. I need to have this. This is going to be an essential part of my practice of homeopathy." And so it really created quite a bit of enthusiasm. So, Luke, I was curious, how did this idea come to you to create the Luke de Shepper module?
Well, never mind how we call it, but basically what I really was always struck by, and, you know, being in the practice myself, I always try to put myself in the place of the student in the first place, because I'm still a student too, and in the place of the practitioner. You know, I have admiration for everybody who is in practice, how we have to deal with a tremendous amount of difficulties being in practice myself. I am faced with that every day. I'm faced every day with the expectations of people, which are enormous, much more than I would put on any of their other doctors. So, again, too, we have to have tools that to some extent help us now getting, I wouldn't say quickly, because there is no quick answer anywhere in any case in homeopathy. There's no easy answers. There are no shortcuts. That's not really the solutions. There is no also deviating from our wonderful principles that we have. But what I thought I wanted to do is create something what is an enormous help for the student who and of course the practitioner, when he comes at the end of his conclusion and he has 2, 3, 4 remedies that are really in the run, to really have some tools to distinguish it very precisely. It is a very difficult task. Just to give you an example, when we have cases, for instance, and it sounds actually to the student maybe, and even to some practitioners, how can that be a challenge? But for instance, a case between Nightmare and Lachesis, for instance, you know, it's an enormous challenge in the practice. For those who have not seen it, I can assure you that it will be a challenge. We talk about remedies like Hyoscyamus and Tarantula, you know, another challenge. I mean, they are so close to each other that precisely what becomes difficult, because don't forget, patients really are brainwashed, in my opinion, as you know, according to Western medicine, are not really normally can answer questions to what you answer one to them. They're not really used to questions like, but why and for what purpose, and give me an example. They're used really to answer a question like, well, you know, here is my headache, give me something. Obviously, for us, that's really not how it goes. But even for us, when we do such an extensive inquiry and workup with the patient, now work an hour and a half with the patient, then still we are really faced with, you know, here we have 2, 3 remedies that are so close to each other. It is not easy. Obviously, you can reach a Materia Medica. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, I would like anybody to invite to read the Materia Medica. And for instance, Herring's Guiding Symptoms is absolutely my favorite, which I use definitely for all my work tremendously. But it's like it looks like a pool of mismatched symptoms because, you know, at one hand you can have taciturn, in the next sentence it says likes to talk. It looks like contradictions all over the place. So I really thought I must find something that it makes it a little easier to distinguish these very close remedies besides what I really already explained in my books, Hahnemann Revisited and Even Achieving the Similimum. I really found there had to be something more that I can help me diagnose the first step in our process, which is difficult enough, that is trying to find the similimum. Of course, the second step is just as equal difficult, if not more difficult, which is the management. But trying to first the first step, of course, with at least certitude, with some certitude, we never have 100% certitude, but with some assurance that we are on the right path, I needed to find something that helps me at the end. And I got very lucky in a way, or I guess I love studying, and I really studied Jung, Carl Jung, our famous professors in psychology, psychiatrist of Vienna, for the last 3-4 years. And I read all his works, there's only 20 volumes, and anything I could get my hand on of Jung. And I really was astonished by his language, which really is really homeopathic in nature. There is no doubt about that. He was an unconscious homeopath. The same terminology, I think he was so successful because he was an unconscious homeopath. Unfortunately for him, he did not have the tools like we have, our remedies. Neither did he know the homeopathic miasmatic theory. He could have, obviously. But we actually have that now. And so for me, I was very grateful to learn so much from not just Hahnemann, of course, in the first place, but also from Jung, and knowing that I have the weapons that Hahnemann have given to me, I could incorporate this into what I considered my most difficult work and really the basis of the module to really resolve some of the difficulties we face. So imagine if you have 2-3 remedies. What we really wanted to do and what I really used from Jung was what we call, you know, he called it the core delusion, he called it the primary delusion, the archaic delusion, you know, the primitive delusion. You know, we have many different names, but they all express the same thing. In other words, if I want to define this, it's really a fixed idea that really goes back to a very, what Jung called actually, a high-feeling toned complex, which is nothing that our never-well sense, usually linked to precisely a very sad event, often, you know, that we actually have experienced, and that has actually become a fixed idea to the extent that we can say we almost can become addicted to this particular sentiment or feeling. And obviously, if it's a core delusion, a mother delusion, that will actually create even further fixed ideas, then it really has to be very strong in nature, and usually it is, you know, sad in nature, that we actually have become addicted to it. And that by itself, this core delusion, makes us do everything what we do. It makes us say everything we do. It makes us plan everything we plan. In other words, it becomes the rudder of your ship, so to speak. It becomes like your guide in your life. And unfortunately for us, it is not always a very friendly ship. In other words, this particular guide is not always good. The core delusions, as much as they are some positive core delusions, and we might discuss that later, there's just many more negative core delusions, which means self-demeaning, coming from a very low point, I am not loved, I am abandoned, I'm all alone in the world, and so on and so on. There's, of course, much more of those very fixed ideas, which then will set us on a path, obviously, of destruction often, and certainly not a positive path ahead.
Fantastic. Luke, since you brought up the subject of the core delusions and the delusions, can you first of all make a distinction between the core delusion and just a normal delusion as we might find it represented in the repertory? And could you maybe give us some examples like of some remedies and how the core delusions would be different and how you might use this to differentiate in practice?
Right, yeah, well, let's give this the most difficult examples of what I really already mentioned. Just to answer the first part of your question, the difference between the core delusion and then the other delusions. Certainly, the core delusion has to be found also in the proving symptoms because everything is based on the proving symptoms of our, you know, our wonderful forefathers there. So let's just say the core delusion of Lachesis, since we talked about Lachesis and Aunt Myrna, the core delusion of Lachesis is injured by her surroundings. The illusion is injured by her surroundings and is wronged. You can clearly see that there is a certain paranoia idea of and therefore neediness for hypervigilance, and therefore also suspicion of anybody else approaching them, everybody anything else doing them. This is really the central idea of this particular core delusion of Lachesis. And if Lachesis maintains this core delusion, which is of course the real true definition of a core delusion, that it becomes a permanent fixed pattern and fixture, I would say, it also is going to create, as the patient goes further, into what we call secondary delusions. And for Lachesis, they become even more paranoid in nature. Then we see delusions coming from this primary delusion, delusions like he's going to be poisoned, the classical thing, or I'm going to be sent away to the asylum. Those are secondary delusions. And it was very interesting to me when I was reading Jung's cases, where I saw one case, which he saw for 25 years, a schizophrenic case, because that's all he was doing between 1903 and 1907, in which he was following this case so beautifully, understanding the patient so well, and yet he could not really do anything to bring this particular person off the target. And when I look at this case, I guess any good homeopath at this point could read the beginning of the case, recognize immediately Lachesis that was needed, and how this particular patient from one, particularly the core delusion, actually during these 25 years came to the pact, to the point that she had now all the delusions that we possibly have under Lachesis. It was most amazing to me that, which of course is to be expected, that if one cannot get free from his core delusion, that basically all the delusions belonging to this particular remedy, Lachesis in this case, will eventually chain the person, and just keep him prisoner, I would say, to his delusions. And of course, eventually, and certainly with Lachesis, which is one of those most volatile remedies, I would call, eventually it will break the person and we go from a neurosis to a psychotic break, and that's, of course, schizophrenia. So it was quite amazing. I was often thinking about Jung and wished I could have told you that. Since you could teach me this much, this is one thing, Hahnemann, or maybe through my mouth, that we could have helped you with these cases. So that's really an example of a core delusion with a remedy and what we find. And to make my example more clear now, like what I was saying from in the beginning, that it's so difficult often to distinguish remedies like Lachesis and Nat Muir, just to give you an example, all the ailments from, be it from disappointed love, being from grief, anger, they're all black type for both remedies. There's no distinction there. So here we have important facets of those both remedies, and yet they are exactly the same. It makes it very, very difficult. Even if we would say we look at even the emotional, what I would call compensations, how do they deal with their particularly core delusion and their fixed ideas, and how do they go through life if they have such a fixed idea, and how will they express it, that is through diseases, through physical ailments. Even there, when we look at Lachesis and Nat Muir, then we see that they have a tremendous amount in common. Even the physical things like palpitations in the morning, headaches in the morning, vertigo in the morning when they wake up, herpes simplex. I was always surprised. I always thought Nat Muir is this number one remedy. Yet, if you look in the provings and if you look in the synthesis, Lachesis is black type and Nat Muir is italic. So surprisingly enough, when I was doing all this work, I could even see more the difficulties that we have in the clinic. And I'm sure that in the past, I was much more inclined to prescribe Nat Muir, where now, when I look at the reality, certainly later in my career, and right now too, that I see that Lachesis is such an underprescribed remedy. And the only way I can distinguish, or certainly the first question I ask myself, to distinguish two very close remedies like this, is what is their core delusion? I already explained to you the core delusion of Nat Muir. I go right away to, okay, what's the core delusion of Nat Muir? And the core delusion of Nat Muir is mother is dead. which means mother again is what Jung would have called the relative fixed symbol for the nourishment, the emotional nourishment for the, I would say, the yin in TCM, certainly for the unconscious. It also stands for that. It stands for the feeling function of Jung. In other words, really for all what is really more feminine. It stands for the anima. So therefore, again, too, mother is that. It can be that the mother truly is that. It can also be that the mother is totally absent, although she is not that. We only think about unfortunate cases of alcoholism or even mental disease, where now the youngster has to take over the role of the mother. I can see this very often. Just this week I had a person, you know, whose mother pushed her at age 7 to become the mother because she would even threaten to commit suicide if she wouldn't do this or do that, you know, the emotional blackmail, so to speak. So this can be very, very early. But mother is that can also be that no other emotional nourishment is present. Mother doesn't need to be mother. It could be father. It could be grandmother. It could be anybody who can have an emotional nourishment. So in other words, as long as somebody would provide, maybe they have a grandmother who is very loving, then this really is not the case that we need to use this particular core delusion. But certainly we have too many cases, I would say, where no emotional nourishment was ever present from young age on. Even intrautero, it's a very special thing that now we should talk about too later, is intrautero, where this whole impact, this whole emotion, where some mothers can say the first time they hear that they are pregnant, oh, I don't want this child. This is not the right moment. This is really that my relationship is not going well. I can't really do this now. Even at that point, there is a rejection of the fetus, and there's no doubt in my mind that the rejection feeling is really sent over to the fetus. So this is all what I would call mother is dead. And you see right away, when I compare it to the Lachesis, we have a different feeling of what this all stands for. As long as I explain, which I do, of course, in the module, what does this core delusion mean? Okay, what does it mean? How I find it, that's a whole different question, of course. But what does it mean? It helps me immediately how to distinguish these two remedies according to what the patient is sitting in front of me. And the next question, of course, will be, so how did they become such a person, the never-well sense, and how do they compensate? But for me, usually the core delusion is so outstanding for the remedy because I chose it after very precise searching through all the delusions of the remedy that, you know, I have no hesitation. It usually makes my task tremendously easier and with more certitude can I then follow up the patient.
Very interesting. So, Luke, if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is that with a remedy like Lachesis and Nat Muir or any of another group of remedies, if you just go by the symptomology, it's difficult oftentimes to differentiate. But if you look at this underlying core delusion, it becomes very easy to make that distinction in practice.
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Again, too, you know, I never thought, I mean, I guess I was having my own delusions of grandeur when I was a beginning student. I never thought that a distinction between Nat Muir and Lachesis should be difficult. You know, when we listen to a portrait for it, whoever presents it to us, the difficulty is there, as you might know, and I probably was guilty in the beginning of my career teaching it that way too, that we only portray a certain portrait of a remedy, not incomplete, of course. You know, usually the most excessive portrait, which really means usually the syphilitic phase of the remedy, rather than the psoriatic or psychotic phase, because the syphilitic is standing out. You know, like we all say about arm, okay, good, that's the one that commits suicide, so to speak. I'm simplifying this now.
Right.
But, you know, for us, it's right away we think about it. Rather than thinking about what are the great psoriatic compensations of aurum so that they do not commit suicide. How do they stay this long on the path before they actually will commit suicide? You know, and what are the reasons for that then? But why is one remedy, like aurum, for instance, versus a remedy like mercury that actually will be more destructive, mercury much more destructive, much quicker than a remedy like aurum, simply because they have the tools to stay on what I would call in the psoriatic phase. But that, again, is never really very much, even in all the material Americas, obviously, is not very much portrayed or really, you know, even when we teach it, and now I teach it that way, of course, because I do according it to the core delusions and the compensations, but we need to portray any remedy in their psoric, psychotic, and syphilitic phase with the hope that as practitioners, understanding it that way, that we can help the patient in the psoric phase before they get actually deep down. You know, it's difficult enough for us. We usually get many patients, of course, when they are in their syphilitic phase because they have been destroyed everywhere else. So then it becomes a lot more difficult.
So Luke, basically what you're saying is that every remedy has a different core delusion. I'm assuming that you're going to say that. You can tell me if that's correct or not. And I'm curious, how many remedies have you worked out the core delusions for at this point?
So far, more than 100, actually. Just to give you an idea, one workup of one remedy like this, it takes me at least 8 hours of very strong, strenuous work. 8 hours, which, of course, I don't have at this point. I only have 15 minutes. But you know, this has been the work of many years already before. Whenever I had somewhere an hour, you know, it takes me 8 hours, actually, for one remedy. And because I have to check basically more than one materia medica, I do check the best ones in my opinion, which is Herring's Guiding Symptoms and T.F. Allen. I go to Hahnemann's Chronic Diseases and Materia Medica Pura and von Bernhausen's Repertorium. So those are all my materia medicas that I check in order to get as much information about it, to check with each other, that they don't contradict each other. So those are my guides, and simply even for my practice, I must say. But what I wanted to do, which I feel is missing even now for the practice, is to put this all together so that it becomes a very lively picture, really truly matching the practice, what we really see. You know, it never fails, like I just did, as you mentioned, over the weekend, 4 days weekend for my students. I already had some of my students bringing me, emailing me back. I know I saw this person. I could clearly see this was the remedy. Now, before I couldn't see it, I gave it to you, and here is the result. Fantastic. You know, in other words, it makes it alive. You know, when it's not, it's in other words, not theoretically. It really is totally practical and clinical, but it's still totally based on the provings. Our only, again, it's not made up. It's not projected by anything else. Not esoteric, not really timbering it out of my term or anything like this. It's solid. It's always based on the provings and the ones that I use from the aforementioned materia medicas, of course.
Fantastic. Look, you said something earlier that intrigued me. You said something about, you know, normally you think of these core delusions as being negative, and you said something about some of them even possibly being positive. Could you clarify that statement?
Yes. You know, indeed, of course, we have a lot more, I would call, negative feelings than or negative events happening to us than positive ones. And when I say a positive core delusion for a person, I would have to put it also in parentheses, because there is no core delusion, there is no delusion or fixed idea that is actually at the end beneficial for the person. In other words, whoever gets stuck and whoever stays stuck, which is the definition of a delusion, in their fixed idea will stop their progress to become a good individual. You know, we call it the individuation process, as Jung called it. It stops their individuation. But again, you can imagine that somebody with a good, and I'm going to give you an example, with what he considers, not anybody else living with him, with what he considers a good core delusion, that he is not in a hurry to come to your office and actually tell you about it, because why would he? You know, for him, nothing is wrong. I'll give you an example. For instance, Vera Trumalbum. You know, they have the delusion that he is a prince. In other words, you can clearly see it is a delusion of grandeur that he has. We all know how, you know, Vera Trumalbum gets really to the point where he is. It really, the motivation why he became this way was really a despair about social position, you know, black type for despair about and only remedy. So he is so despairing about a social position that if he gets the tools, and usually he gets maybe an inheritance of his mother or something, which is, you know, a bad thing for somebody like this, because now he can behave himself like a prince. And he, you know, again, with the illusion of grandeur, squandering his money, as it says, for Vera Trumalbum, where he will now preach for everybody on the streets, and now he is now all of a sudden the Jesus on the street. But basically now he found his niche, so to speak. He thinks he is somebody of importance. They really get even, I have several ones of those in my practice, they even get the idea that they should be, of course, seen by the Pope when he's in town, and whoever is in town, Mandela or ever any important person, they feel they have to have an audience, a private audience with them. So for them, he says, no, it's great. I feel like a prince. Why shouldn't I? It's good for me. They translate this as having confidence, as having able to do things very easily. But the bottom line is that they really will do stupid things. It's foolish, of course, when you see Willy from Alban squandering his money. Of course, he lies, he cheats at the same time. But he gets away with it because he has the money and he can do it. Now, that's just one example of, what he would call a positive delusion. But anybody living with him, and I only have to talk to the women who live with him, how absolutely difficult it is because they're aggressive, they're violent, because they just have one track mind, and that's being religious and babbling and foolish babbling and thinking they're changing the world. So, it's not really good for anybody, neither for the individual, as much as he thinks, why should you want to change me? Why would you like to take this away from me? The bottom line is that it becomes destructive at the end. Eventually, any psychotic behavior, as I just talked about it, the loquacity, the strong religiousness, any strong psychotic behavior of such an individual will eventually lead to destructive behavior, syphilis, no doubt about it, and not just destruction of himself, but also of everybody around him. That's of course not a good thing. And there's many remedies, by the way, that do have this positive delusions. If I think about the delusions of grandeur, I only had to think about Platina, of course, who thinks she doesn't belong to this world, and who doesn't think her family does not belong to her family, of course. Now, then we know for them initially that does sound like a very positive delusion. It sounds like a person with nothing but fantastic self-confidence. But as you know about Platina too, eventually it leads to severe pathology, slowly but severe pathology. And I talk about multiple sclerosis, about other central nervous systems, paralysis, first numbness in the cheek, and the os sigmaticus, classical symptoms, and then, of course, destruction on the central nervous system, just to mention the physical plane.
Luke, the thing that impresses me really the most about the module is all the incredible materia medica that you put in there with the concepts and the core delusions. I mean, just that alone is incredibly invaluable. So I really want to acknowledge all the efforts and work that you put into making that together, because it's really very, very impressive. But what I actually like to ask you about is there's a part of the module that before you actually get to the delusion part where it differentiates the remedies for you based on the core delusion, where you're actually, it's organizing information for you according to various categories. Can you tell us a little bit about your ideas about that and how this fits into your philosophy of homeopathy?
Yes. Obviously, before I come to the conclusion, or maybe to the 3, 4, 5 top remedies, I guess that's what you asked me, right?
Yeah.
How do I come to that?
Yeah.
Obviously, there had to be, again, what I would call a hierarchy of symptoms, which is definitely done by some of our wonderful old masters. One of my favorites is Pierre Schmidt of Switzerland, who was very good at it too. And where we know practically when a patient comes to us that he comes with a chief complaint, which is typically the tip of the iceberg, and that's why I really chose that particularly symbol for my module, because I wish patients would come to me and say, "Oh, Dr. Luke, this is my core delusions. Just go ahead and give me the remedy." That would be wonderful, but it never happens. Or I wish they could easily say to me, "And these are my positive and negative compensations." If anything, the bottom line is that the core delusion, and that's why it's really the last thing to access in this module too, the core delusion is really the most hidden in every person. We all have a core delusion. And if you don't think so, that's exactly your core delusion. So we all have one, and it's hidden in what Jung have called the shadow side. So it is a difficult task to see what we do as a homeopath. We actually go fish for the most difficult thing to find, which is hidden in the you know, shadow side. It's not present where most of the practitioners, and I don't have to mention about anything, it can be any modality practically, except TCM, will actually just go for the mask and on the presenting symptoms, as we call it. We, when we say we prescribe on our presenting symptoms, we still actually have a hierarchy of symptoms. It isn't like we get accused sometimes, I guess, even by allopathic physicians who really don't know anything about homeopathy, that we prescribe on symptoms. Well, actually they do, not us. They prescribe on the mask of the patient, on the persona, and actually just on one facet of it, the one that stands out the most, so we can give a drug, suppress that facet, and we'll take care of the rest later. That's, of course, totally wrong, and that's not what we do, even if we would call it prescribing on the presenting symptoms. So we need to, of course, we know the aphorism 153 hierarchy, the strains rare and peculiar, but even in there is a hierarchy in symptoms. And when the patient comes to you, this is my chief complaint, which basically you always have to ask anyway, otherwise you think you don't even listen to him, then you know this is just the tip of the iceberg. Your investigation has just started. It's like the story of the patient that he's going to tell you, and you need to discover the rest of the iceberg underneath, and it's all hidden. And like I said, the most hidden is the core delusion, because as you go from the top, that which is the top to the bottom, the top being the chief complaint and the bottom being the core delusion, we have other things coming in there, as such as, for instance, again, sleep, position of sleep, sex, you know, then the particular symptoms, then comes the, then we have, you know, in order of increasing order of importance, after particular symptoms, which are local symptoms, we have the general physical symptoms, then we have, of course, the emotional symptoms, and that brings us, of course, also then to, before we even have the cravings and aversions, but that's before the general symptoms, and then we have, obviously, the emotional symptoms, which are peculiar, and then come, once we have that, we actually already have four or five remedies, and the module always takes at least five top remedies in account, where now you are at a very good distinction, to make a distinction between those five remedies. And here is the difficulty, which one? Because many times, I can assure you, you see a picture of maybe one or two or three remedies even, and now, and those are the top remedies, now comes the difficult task, which one? We don't want to give all five to the patient. We want to be more assured about our choice. This is when we really can access in the module what the core delusion is. When you click on it, it brings you the core delusion of the five top remedies. It explains to you what it is, and then you can actually go to each of those remedies and go to, indeed, what you're saying, the materia medica that I presented, as I just said shortly about, again, Lachesis with the primary delusions followed by the secondary delusions, the compensations. You can read all of it as it comes to life, as it really comes from the practice. And that's the enormous work that I had to do for 4 years and actually do for the next 3 years, because it will be also the basis of a book that's already now 1,500 pages, just to give you an idea. So it's the ones who have the module have absolutely an early look at this whole book, which I don't know when I'm going to finish the book, but that's what I've been teaching for all these years before now.
Luke, I don't know if you noticed, but you know, as you begin to discover the symptoms underneath that are, you know, that are underlying the chief complaint in the module, did you notice that the iceberg actually gets lighter? It clarifies.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, I just thought that was. I didn't notice it myself until one of your students pointed it out to me, and I thought that was, they really did a nice little trick with that, because it actually becomes lighter as you.
I actually had
more.
Asked them that, yeah, but I actually didn't pay attention. I must say, I wanted to actually the iceberg come out of the water, but that's just as good when it gets lighter.
Yeah, I thought that was great. I didn't know until I was there. Actually, and one of your students pointed it out. So, Luke, this is absolutely fantastic, the work that you're doing, and I know that you're continuing to do some additional work relative to the module with the miasms. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Well, that's, of course, the other gigantic task. Right now, what we have available, when it comes to when we say, well, we need a very syphilitic miasmatic remedy for our patient, we need a very psychotic one, we need a very psoriatic one. What we have so far, unfortunately, because it is such a gigantic task, I think, it's very hard to find any book that explains just, okay, pulsatilla, what exactly is the miasmatic division of it? You know, what is it? Is it 30% psoriatic? Is it 20% syphilitic? And so on and so on. In other words, a very precise idea, because as we look at a case, for instance, we try to see what's the dominant miasmatic predisposition of this patient. You're always going to find expressions, if you know well the miasms, of the three miasms. But obviously one will stand out, the dominant miasmatic background, the latest one, the one obviously where you have to prescribe on. Because if psychosis was in the past, but now you have syphilis, you don't have to prescribe when it comes down to two, three remedies. You want to choose then the great anti-syphilitic remedy among those three. It is another tool, I would say, and a very important one, to distinguish the remedies that you want to choose besides the core delusion. It's a very additional one. Now, how difficult it is to really do this, it has to be precise. I know there are some books out there that say, well, whatever, tarantula, you know, psora 1+, and psychosis 2+, and you know, syphilis 3+. It doesn't really mean anything, because on what is that based? In other words, anybody can say so, but one has to be able to see, but how did he find this? Just like I have the whole explanation about the core delusion of all these remedies. How did I find it? But same thing for the miasmatic background. How did I find it? The only way to find it is to go, let's just say tarantula, to give an example, is to go over all the proving symptoms from the mind till the generalities, okay, the whole repertorium, the whole materia medica, really, all the proving symptoms, line by line. Each line has to be given a denominator. Is it psoriatic, psychotic, or syphilis? Now, I did this with several things already. I don't know. I'm really probably halfway with that work done, because I'm sidetracked by many other things. But when you do it this way, the computer has a fantastic tool where we can now extract all this information. Once I have put all this denomination to all these proving symptoms, each of one remedy, you can imagine that for one remedy, it probably takes me a whole week just to do it, 8 hours a day, for sure, if not longer. And then we can extract this, and we can say with precisely, okay, tarantula, I say something, it's not correct now, is, you know, 19.7% psoriatic, it's probably 35%, 0.9 psychotic, and it's another whatever the rest is left, 60 so much percent syphilitic. That gives us a very precise indication of how syphilitic, how psychotic, and how psoriatic is this remedy. It is a fantastic tool for us, because once one prescribed on the miasmatic dominating background of the patient, you know that you're going to have a lot more success. Again, we could not do. People who don't really practice and know the theory of miasms, which I explain in Hahnemann Revisited, and also now in my next upcoming book, they really lose a lot of things. You know, they can still be successful, but it's like a hit and miss. Why should we do hit and miss? The work of homeopathy is difficult already to start with, and we need to use our tools that people have worked so hard on. We need to use them to make it a little easier, and certainly to make more certitude and more confidence in you that you prescribe a remedy for a person, because at that point, even when it comes to the what you want to do with the patient further in the management, you're not going to make too many mistakes, because you know you're on the right track, and you want to investigate in the management exactly all the different possibilities, but not necessarily changing the remedy right away, which, in my opinion, is one of the greatest mistakes that's always done.
Very interesting. So do you use, Luke, only the psora, psychosis, syphilis, or are you also looking at the tubercular miasm or the so-called cancer miasm as well?
I used to, as I explained probably in Hahnemann Revisited, you know, and I keep on studying myself so as to make more clarity in all this, even if anything to make it more easy. I used to consider those five miasms that you just mentioned, but when I really studied for about the 250th time the organon, simply because I'm always nosing it when I write my books and do research, then I really realized that I made a mistake in that. And I can see now it's easier for me to do it for the patients too. So in my next book that is coming out in about 1 month now, the homeopathic guide for the professional practice, I have a big chapter, what I call Miasms Revisited. Simply because when you start at Aphorism 78, you can clearly see that Hahnemann really talks about three main miasms. He also talks about half-acute miasms, that's just one thing, but only three chronic main miasms, psoriasis and syphilis. And I was struck by his wording in this Aphorism 78, which I would everybody who is listening to read, look very carefully at it. I was struck by his wording when it came to psychosis, where he talked about psychosis underbuilt and overbuilt. In other words, prolapse, now too much and too little, which at the beginning I probably translated wrong years ago, that is, which I could understand now, that basically they are the picture of psychosis. In other words, a prolapse of a uterus is just as much psychosis as an induration, an indurated tumor or something like this, where an indurated tumor is obviously psychosis overbuilt, where a prolapse of the uterus would be psychosis underbuilt, but not psora. Okay, so this is really was really a good thing for me, and what I use it for then is to say, let me analyze the symptoms of this patient. I get an excellent idea of the patient sitting in front of me, where I can say he is mainly psora, I call it big P, and there is some syphilis, I call it a small L, in there. So then I know I have to have a remedy in the provings in order to be successful that is equally big P and small L. Okay, and here, you know, you see the importance for us to really know the precise makeup of the remedies in the Materia Medica. I have it a little bit in my mind, using it all the time. But yes, I hope I live long enough to do the work for the module and the book to really get that to an end too.
Fantastic, Luke. Well, I see that we're getting close to the time where I should invite some of the other people to participate. But before I do that, Luke, could you tell us a little bit about the new book you're working on, any classes that you're doing, anything else that you want to share about that?
Well, I finished a new book that will come out next month, as I mentioned. I just finished a class. I have my last class maybe for a little while here in the United States, in my own class in Albuquerque, July 17 to 20th. Again, several new patients, new students really joined the class, and we're extremely happy. We're happy to see them. As long as they know, really have read Achieving the Minimum and Hahnemann Revisited, there's no doubt that they can follow this and can build up for their practice. That's definitely the case. After July, for my own classes, I do not know how much I can do it because I'll go everywhere around the world at the same time, and I'm busy making three other books before I come to the Miasmatic book, I want you to know. One will be for the autistic families. The next one will be a Dreams and Jung, about so to incorporate dreams for, it's a wonderful, wonderful tool. I'm enjoying it every day, and I love to teach it to all. I have done so to my students to some extent, but also going to write, that's my next book about it, homeopathy and interpretation of dreams, non-existent in our homeopathic world at this point. Then, of course, comes my book, what I call Beyond Jung, Homeopathy and Delusions, what I just talked about it, more than 100 remedies with their exquisite picture that we just talked about, core delusion, and in which I will also put, after every picture that I describe, most of the time, a picture directly from the practice, straight from the practice, very elaborate with, where I really help the student, I guess, and the practitioner to learn the language, how to translate the language of the patient into the language of the repertorium. So that's number three, and then number four before the miasms will be homeopathy and TCM, because I have really seen that TCM, traditional Chinese medicine, which I have been teaching for the last 3 years also to my students in homeopathy, and who were very enthusiastic about it. They're not going to put needles in people, but what I taught them, how the emotions can be helped to recognize it, personality, temperament, climate factors, food factors, again, very practical tools for the homeopath to say with certitude, well, you should not eat this food, rather than giving a blend diet or a diet that is too extreme to anybody, or knowing this climate affects it, this emotion affects you the most, and I can see how complicated cases go from one element to another. So there's too much in my head still that I have to get out of it. And I hope that I don't go too soon to Hahnemann, because he's not ready for me anyway.
So, and Luke, if people want more information about your books or the classes you're teaching, they can go to your website?
They just go simply to my website, indeed, yeah. drluc.com, drluc.com. I always will be in close contact and try to see it. I'm sure Whole Health Now will always know much about me too. Again, to never think, well, I'm going to do it next time. Next time will not be there because I'm too busy with next times.
Fantastic. Well, you know, as I said at the beginning of the call, Luke is one of our most important homeopathic educators and practitioners, and his students absolutely love him. You know, if you ever go to any of his classes, they just simply rave about how much they're getting out of him, and actually more than how much they're getting out of it, how much they can actually go out themselves and take his information and actually be able to effectively practice homeopathy themselves. So all of us, thank you very much for that, Luke. And let me go ahead and open it up to the other people on the call. So does anybody have a question that they would like to ask Dr. Luke?
I do.
Yes, I have.
Krishna, you can go second.
All right.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead. The first person who said they had a question.
This is Lucy DePiri from Canada. And Dr. Luke, thank you so much for all your work. And I've really been following your articles on autistic children and the way that the question that you suggested to ask the parents are just most useful to me. I would like your advice on this case, if possible. I have a 4-year-old boy with eczema and autism, and I've been reading him since November 2007. He was a very clear picture of tarantula, and I prescribed tarantula 12 on a fit dose, and the eczema improved, moving from the chest to the wrists, and there was some improvement on the autistic symptoms. In March, I saw a completely different child. The eczema seems not to be healing so much, but the child was starting to talk and had become more sensitive towards his external environment.
Mm-hmm.
He also wanted to play with toys and with people, and he wanted to cuddle, something that he never done, not even as a baby. And sometimes he was interested in relating to other people. I prescribed phosphorus 6 as a split dose, and I saw the child just a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking a lot more, full sentences now, and the tantrums were less, and there's a lot, and it was also a lot easier to resolve, and he was less sensitive towards his environment, and he wanted to play with other kids and adults, and he was very unhappy when he was by himself. He was making eye contact. He called me by name. However, the eczema is somehow worse, and he scratches until he bleeds. The mother seems to be a lot more concerned about the eczema, and I'm thinking that perhaps the progress, because it has been falling Herring's law, and I think maybe the eczema might be the last symptoms to resolve. Is my thinking correct? And what
okay, that's a good. Well, I guess you said first the remedy was tarantula, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you something about this now, which you might learn from. You know, you're doing a good job, apparently. What you need to keep in mind is this. What you're doing is exteriorization. In other words, a rash, even if the child never had a rash, it's one of those wonderful things that you must show as what we call exteriorization and a treatment, and definitely the direction of the cure. So when I hear you saying that the rash actually comes more out while the child is talking, better visual contact, better eye contact, and so on and so on, more playing, and so on and so on, first of all, I would not have changed tarantula in the first place to phosphorus. I'm not sure why you did it, because as you described it, everything was really going the right direction. Make sure never to succumb to these rashes. And I know parents start, you know, amazingly enough, they start thinking about the rash would go away while all you have does this wonderful improvements on the child, what you just described, mentally, emotionally. Then you must realize that the appearance of a rash is actually getting closer to the cure. It's exteriorization. It is not really a disease process. It's just a relief route. You should never change the remedy because of it. Never should you try to match your remedy to the eczema, for sure. You definitely we're on the right track, and I even think we're on the right track with tarantula. I just want to say one word about tarantula. I call it a volatile remedy for a volatile child, a restless child, as you know, often violent even. One has to really follow up very, very well with the parents, to not repeat too often, to keep the doses very low, especially the dose. I give drops to those children, one drop, you know, one drop from the bottle in a cup, one drop, even one succussion, and they can go with one dose for 15, 20 days. It's talking about tarantula children right now, and it's absolutely marvelous. But don't change the remedy when you see this improvement, what you did. You were doing a good job there. Like I said, I'm not sure why the phosphorus came, but the last thing you should be, and I know parents will bug you to put, just make sure they don't put anything on the eczema. If the child gets too much irritation, too much itching, there's also some natural baths they can take, or you can, of course, and this is part of it, as I just mentioned, you must adjust your remedy frequency-wise, the interval in which you give your remedy. You want to make sure that you don't do it too quickly, so you can slow down the process by giving it more infrequent, and certainly decrease your dose. That is very helpful. Keep your potency, whatever, you know, potency and succussions you were doing. I would advise you definitely to bring it down to drops, not teaspoons, not half teaspoons, but one drop, and the process of exteriorization and discomfort for the child is much, much better. So that's actually what you need to do.
Fantastic. So, Lucy, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Do you think it would be a good idea to go back to the tarantula? Because the child was completely different. I saw phosphorus, the way he was relating to me and to, you know, to people. I couldn't quite see tarantula. Before, he was hitting me. You know,
yeah.
He was hitting me.
Yeah, of course, exactly. He's violent, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, but don't forget, since you did the tarantula and it improves, I would not leave tarantula. The picture will change unless there's two different layers, because if you give a different remedy like phosphorus, it means, which I doubt, in a child that young, would have to, it's happening, but it can happen. I actually have an example myself, but it can happen. But, you know, if you give two different remedies, that means you have two different layers, and definitely then you have two different core delusions with two different symptoms, and that you have to be very sure of. The way you explain it to me or hear it, I don't really see this right away. I would not have left it, but I can be wrong because obviously I don't know the case as well as you.
Very good.
Thank
I think
so
we're kind of getting close on running out of time, but does somebody have another question they'd like to
yes,
ask?
Yes, I've got Krishna speaking.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, I have a doctor friend. He's a pathologist, and he got miraculous results with homeopathy, so he got hooked to it. Well, I gave him some advice. He's a chronic case of kidney problem and extreme salt sensitivity. He gets swelling of the face and abdomen and all that. So, and he fits into Lycopodium. So I gave him Lycopodium LM potency, NM1, only one drop. Once a day. So he.
One drop from what? From the bottle or what?
One drop from the bottle, LM potency, LM1, prepared in the dose, you know, like alcohol and all that.
Yeah, yeah. So one drop directly from the bottle.
Directly from the bottle.
Once a day.
Once a day, but what happened that he just gave time to work it, so he stopped for. Only took one dose, and here comes, he had gout, quite many, you know, attacks of gout, mm-hmm. and he got better with Belladonna each time, but mm-hmm. it keeps on coming, but he was fitting with Lycopodium so much, so I started Lycopodium. At that time, there was not gout, but it precipitated gout, it came back, and so he felt nice that, of course, look, my these things are exteriorizing. So he just didn't take any remedy, neither even Lycopodium. And he got better. And then again, another attack will come after a few days. Then again, it will get better. But then the third attack came, and he is to flying to California. He said, let me treat it with Belladonna. And as he took Belladonna, again, the symptoms got aggravated. Instead of getting better, initially he was getting better with Belladonna, but now he got aggravation with Belladonna.
What
so
symptoms came better with Belladonna? What are you talking about?
No, what's, because what? Gout.
Oh, the gout? Okay, go ahead. I understand.
So then what I thought in chronic cases and lycopodium, sulfur is the king of antipsoriasis. And I was thinking to give him sulfur, one dose, of course, as you say, in drops or after dissolving it in water, succussing it. But do you think it is right that instead of Belladonna, I should have, you know, I didn't give him Belladonna, he took himself.
Yeah.
Sulfur is better if suppose there is attacks of gout are coming again, which he had initially and got control with Belladonna.
Okay.
So I was,
Let me answer sulfur. There is enough to answer on your question anyway, because there are different aspects that you should learn about. Number one, you never give your remedy of LM1 directly from the bottle. Never want you to give that every day. That's not what you should do, but you got away with it and you got lucky simply because the patient stopped the remedy by himself. So that's one thing you should not do is, you know, you should really follow the sixth edition, which means, you know, you do a test dose, you know, again, maybe one drop. It's good to take one drop, at least that was good. I mean, you could take a half teaspoon from the bottle in a cup of 4 ounces, and you stir and give him a half teaspoon as a test dose, and then you need to see the third day, how often can I repeat. Never do it mechanically. That's how you're going to get trouble immediately. Number two, lycopodium is a wonderful remedy, by the way, for gout. If you look at it in the repertorium, it's black type remedy for lycopodium. So that remedy by itself, if it's given to the patient in a very well way, now this is a chronic, now gout is also a mixed miasmatic state, okay, so it's not just psora, it's a mixed, gout is a mixed miasmatic state, it's psychosis, psora, it has all of it. So if you would give perfectly chronically, because all that you see, what he has is what we call an acute exacerbation of a chronic miasmatic state, if you give the lycopodium in the right way, I mean, according to an LM1, and you do it exactly as needed, and we don't call it that fourth edition, it's a lot faster according to the fifth and sixth edition, then you're actually going to cure it. And there is no reason, first of all, for Belladonna, which is not really a good remedy so much for an acute gout attack. I mean, if anything, urticaria urens, you know, is definitely one of the more common ones. But I must say, even the lycopodium itself, when people have somewhat a resurgence of the gout, the lycopodium, if repeated on time, will actually avoid such an attack and do away with the attack, I can assure you, within which I have seen, within 10 minutes. Okay, so that's all I have to say. There's a lot to say about it, but must make sure not to make a mistake with your management there. You want to have much more control over it. You want to make sure that you do, that you're careful with repetition, because the biggest mistakes are not really so much with the potency selection, but with the repetition and the dose is a lot more, you know, a mistake in everywhere that I see in the world.
So lycopodium itself will cover it?
Yeah, yeah, of course. It's absolutely phenomenal remedy, black type remedy. You know, if you look under arthritic joints, general, you know, extremities joints, arthritic, black type remedy, big toe, right side, black type remedy, lycopodium.
Fantastic. Well, Luke, again, you've done a wonderful job of sharing with us very valuable information. And for those of you who have not yet looked into the Luke DeShepherd module, you can either go to the Whole Health Now website, and you'll see a direct link right at the bottom right-hand side of the logo. If you click on that, it'll take you to the web page that will describe more about the Luke DeShepherd module, the work that Luke has put into making it happen. If you would like to make a phone call and get more information about it, you can call toll-free 888-722-5423. That's 888-722-5423. Luke, thank you again so much. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
You're welcome.
We really enjoy all of your wonderful information, your wonderful knowledge, and the heart with which you deliver it. It's really fantastic. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much,
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All the best to all of you.